Welcome to a special edition of Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. We've traveled to New York City to take part in Climate Week conversations. Now, here's your host, Tucker Perkins.
I'm fascinated by the intersection of environmental policy and finance, so I'm really looking forward to speaking with our guest for this episode of Path to Zero. Sylvia Pavoni is the founding editor of Sustainable Views, a new platform by the Financial Times Group. It gives readers insight into how environmental, social, and governance principles are reshaping capital as it flows into the emerging sets of policy and regulations driving this change. Sylvia, so great to have you in New York. Thanks for joining us on Path to Zero.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So glad to have you because we're going to talk a lot about this intersection that's not talked about enough, the intersection of finance and climate. So looking forward to talking about that. But first, let's give you a chance. I'm a big fan of Financial Times, maybe a bigger fan of Sustainable Views from Financial Times. Tell us about what you do every day and kind of why you do it.
Sure. So Sustainable Views is a new title, which is part of the Financial Times Group, so the company rather than the newspaper. And the company has, in addition to the wonderful daily Financial Times, publication also a number of titles that look at specific audiences or specific subjects. And I've been with the company for many, many years, 18 years, I think I'm coming up to 18 years now, and I've been writing pretty much about banking the whole time. And during my time at The Banker, which is one of the titles part of the group, I started doing this newsletter on the side, almost in secrecy. Trying to that's always the case. And I had a few colleagues that I kind of, you know, brought with me, both from marketing, the commercial side, tech, design, and all of that. So we were just doing our newsletter, was monthly, and I was gathering a few opinions and interviews exactly about this, about the intersection of finance, policy, and corporate investment. So what businesses do, where they go, what kind of things interest them. And so there was some traction, and then after a few months, I knocked at the door of one of our board members at DFT, and I told him, why don't we just expand this and make it into a standalone product? Now, of course, DFT has a wonderful coverage of all the subjects, but what I thought was missing is something that was a little bit more granular. So we talk about the vertical rather than the horizontal lines, the horizontal line being the Financial Times and we being the vertical in all of this. And so we started it, and we basically were running it as a startup, which is the cool thing to say, although, of course, we are part of a really conservative group. So our equity investors, I like to think about it, is very, very conservative, which is also good. Now we have it. So now there is a daily content, a daily newsletter, a policy tracker, where you can go and find information about any kind of policies from a list of 2,300 items. And that keeps on growing. We want to expand it. We want to make it easier to navigate and easier for anyone who has no time really to look into these things, which is pretty much everyone, to find information that they need quickly and effectively.
Because really prior to that, there really wasn't a good place to go and maybe quickly see kind of where, what is the role of corporate finance, particularly private equity, what's going on there. Really wasn't, there wasn't a great single resource.
So the one thing that was missing, we thought, is information, precise information about policy and regulation. Because whether you are interested in sustainable finance or sustainability, the one thing that no one can really avoid is the regulators mandating how certain things need to be done, particularly now when we talk about disclosures. And this is a subject that is of relevance, not just for financial companies, but for any kind of company, and not just in Europe, which is where I am based. I'm based in London, so geographically part of Europe, the UK and the EU. But also in the States, you're seeing a lot of movements from the financial regulator, the SEC, looking at mandating disclosures for listed companies, but also the Californian lawmakers looking at even more precise and strict requirements in terms of disclosures for their companies. So we thought that there wasn't really anything that was providing that kind of information to this group of professionals, which is still a nascent profession, you know, the chief sustainability officer. initially it was under marketing and communication. So you can imagine that sends a different signal. And now it's being moved around the company. And in some companies, that position reports into the CFO, the chief financial officer. So you can see the impact that these people actually, that kind of profession has on the ability of companies to raise capital. And it's also a community that perhaps traditionally has been feeling a little bit alone within the companies they work for, a group of evangelicals maybe, kind of banging the head against the wall and trying to get everyone to realize the importance of what they were talking about and professing, perhaps in some cases.
You know, a lot of people here this week have really been talking about for this whole climate movement to gain traction, it's going to require not only public investment, but private investment that probably matches or exceeds public investment. We see in U.S., clearly we lead in the public investment. I would probably say in Europe, you lead with private investment. But how do you help? I mean, really not a consensus around what are the right solutions, certainly not a consensus around what's the right time frame. How do you help guide investors, particularly private investors, but also public investors, thinking about picking winners and picking losers and navigating this maze where we don't have consensus. Technology is emerging every day. Some solutions are failing away. Some solutions are rising up. And economics are always murky. How do you give them advice in that climate?
It's fascinating. So I'm actually just coming from a discussion on blended finance, and which speaks exactly to what you're talking
blended
about.
Blended would be public, private.
Yes,
right?
So blended finance is essentially when development banks come in, and these are banks that obviously get their funding from donor countries, say the states being one of the major ones when it comes to the World Bank and the IFC, which is the private sector arm of the World Bank. And they would put some money into a project that they deem to be useful in terms of, for example, dealing with climate change. And they put this money in the project in a way that it may absorb risk. So if there is a loss, they will be happy to take that loss. And what that means is that encourages private sector money to also go to the project that maybe they would have stayed away from because they would have considered it perhaps, whether rightly or wrongly, too risky. And particularly in an environment in which there's so many other options for investors, for asset managers, institutional investors, but even banks, when we think about lending, to go to, then that's it's an interesting proposition. So having the development banks using government's funding, essentially, to keep the risk, to lower the risk of certain investments so that capital money, private sector capital can come in. And so we're speaking to Susan Land at the IFC, the International Finance Corporation, which is part of the World Bank. And she was saying that these are her words, so we will have to fact check this. But she was saying that for every $1 that the IFC puts into a project, that generates the equivalent of $10 of private capital. Now, which is a great ratio, right? But then looking at some official numbers that the IFC released in terms of their blended finance activity, the ratio was different. So Susan was talking about climate finance in particular, but then looking at the overall blended finance, the ratio was slightly different, again, based on these IFC official figures. And anyway, the results, what they could get in terms of private investments was in the range of like $13 billion. Now, billion being made available against what is needed, which is trillions, right? Everyone is talking about trillions that are needed annually from now to 2050 to really transition to the green economy. Now, the IFC is one multilateral institution. There are plenty of others, but it is nonetheless a really important and influential one. So yeah, there is a big question mark about what governments can do to support and galvanize investment in these in these projects. And there is a big question mark around policy as well, which is one of the key themes that keep on coming up in my conversations here at Climate Week.
And one of those last conversations, that's excellent about blended finance, one of those last conversations that's probably the thorniest of all is how do we engage the developing nations, right? How do we give them a clean climate but a growing lifestyle? And yet, who pays for that? Are you a part of that conversation as well?
We definitely cover it because, of course, it's something that is becoming more widely discussed and accepted as a responsibility of so-called developed economies. And so there was a commitment, there is a commitment by developed economies of, you know, putting hundreds of billions of dollars annually towards helping developing economies moving towards the green transition. These commitments have kind of been, you know, largely not met yet. And there is also a growing conversation around climate justice. So we wrote recently about nine island nations actually going to court and demanding that that the contribution to climate change of developing nations is taken into consideration, and that they are essentially repaired, they're going to receive funds to deal with a crisis that they haven't really contributed to creating.
So I followed that article, actually. I've been following that story. And so now it's in court. But even if the court were to rule in favor of the plaintiff, yeah, kind of hard to imagine a scenario where money would actually transact, do you think? Or do you think that?
The thing is that there are lots of pledges that then are left unmet. And that's part of our jobs, right? Yours and mine as well. So to highlight the difference between the word and the action. But the thing with the climate litigation, that is one of the things I keep on, to be honest, talking about at conferences when they are so kind to invite me to speak or moderate panel discussions. Climate litigation is useful to raise awareness around the importance of these subjects, because it does galvanize action, right? So, and it can come, by the way, from either side. It could come from people thinking that maybe there is greater attention paid to sustainable finance and investments, but mostly comes from companies, from group of citizens, from youth. We had the youth case, the successful lawsuits by a group of youth against the Montana administration. So these kind of cases are growing, and that again galvanizes action. So there is a power of communities and the power of voters, and that definitely influences what politicians and policymakers will do, will commit to doing.
Let's stay on reporting a little bit, because I think you have been kind of a beacon of light for us around reporting on environmental, social, and governance initiatives, what we would tend to just call ESG. ESG is clearly under attack, a lightning rod. If you're against it, or, you know, to a degree, it's about companies being allowed to greenwash. I'm a huge proponent of staying the course with ESG, because at least it will improve as a metric. But your writings have really been really eye-opening around ESG. How do we move forward with some reporting criteria that keeps pledgers honest, corporations honest, and gives us accurate data?
Yes, I mean, ESG is a bit of a mess, right? So it came out as, first of all, it's a clunky abbreviation. It's a clunky grouping of things that don't always go well together. And there tends to be still a confusion around what it means. So initially it was meant to be understood as a risk way of, under the risk lens, right? So how are companies dealing with these risks? And how does that impact their financial return, their ability to actually attract capital and pay employees at the end of the month? But then when you look at sustainable investment, so you're looking at a fund that maybe would be called ESG something, a lot of people's assumption is that that fund is going to invest in things that are green and that are contributing to the transition. But then particularly, in the case of funds that are passively managed, a lot of stuff ends up going under that umbrella that wouldn't naturally be associated to this area, such as banks. So that's when a lot of the regulatory action has been gathered around. And in Europe, again, there is the Sustainable Finance Disclosure Regulation that tells funds that if they say they are concentrated around these characteristics, environmental, social, and governance characteristics, then they need to disclose certain elements. But even that has then led to confusion, because it was interpreted and ended up being used as a labeling system. It was meant to be a disclosure regime. But you have a lot of essentially of activity around how you call these things. And ultimately, perhaps we should just focus on what they do rather than this ESG label. And I personally believe that ESG is on the way out. Again, it was useful in getting our minds around this concept, but perhaps it's not proving to be too useful in getting the results.
And do you see the next iteration of
Yes,
ESG?
I don't know what it's going to be called, but I know that a lot of people are also finding that perhaps it's past its
Really nice. You know, you wrote about the Conference of Parties. Interesting, because I had never seen it this way, and then I saw other writers kind of join in and say you were right, that it's really not anything more than an investment banking conference.
Yeah, there was an interesting conversation. I'm glad you brought it up. So it was a conversation with an investor, and you wrote about it, and you write about it. And this person was like, absolutely not, never again. I'm not going to go there. It's just an investment banking conference. There is no point in me showing up. I mean, that's what it is. And to a certain degree, a lot of these events are, because there's so many people coming, they are being used to close deals that may or may not help towards dealing with climate change. So we need to ask ourselves, what is better? Do we want to have something that is more close away from the public, where policymakers gather and they actually negotiate and come up with solutions and decisions? Do we want it to make something that is a little bit more inclusive? And that's why also COP in theory is so big, because in theory it should be open to anyone, any citizen. Mm-hmm. And I was in Glasgow. I couldn't go to the one in Sharm el-Sheikh, but was in Glasgow. And you could see, all different people coming, children, older people as observers. They were clearly there to observe the talks. Do we want to do that and leave the deal makers out of it? It's a question that I think we should ask ourselves. And I know that many, I believe, even within the UN, are actually considering this question.
This year next year, I guess, will be essentially interesting, given its venue. Do you think it will be successful as we think about really engaging in a talk about how to move forward?
Yeah, it remains to be seen, right? So there's been so much criticism around the UAE hosting COP. Then on the other hand, you're hearing not everyone, but a lot of people also saying, but it's right, that's the right thing to do. We need to involve oil producing countries and get them to the table and commit. It is one of those things that will have to be monitored very closely. And again, it's part of our job to do so.
Because again, as we come back to finance, the one thing that stands out is those oil producing countries, BP, those companies, BP, Exxon, Shell. If nothing else, they have the infrastructure, the personnel, sometimes the abilities, and certainly the finance, to be able to drive some solutions. It's almost there's this dichotomy between, well, those are the groups that brought us to these problems. They couldn't possibly be part of the solutions. To the other thing, I would argue, they can execute any solution.
So no, it's a logical argument, yeah. Absolutely. Then we've seen what has happened with oil and gas prices shooting through the roof and lots of money to be made. And a few green commitments being abandoned. So the question is, where do we stand? I mean, as long as investing in fossil fuels is highly profitable, what are we asking investors to do? What are we expecting investors to do? And again, perhaps we need to go back and have a chat with the policymakers.
And as you certainly have a global view, perhaps the best global view of almost anybody reporting it, do you see a fundamental change in attitude from Europe to Asia to Africa to South America to North America? Do you see, or even Australia, I guess I should include, do you see a varying view, or is there?
It's interesting because Europe tends to be more accepting of rules and regulation. It's just the way that Europe tends to work, and to a certain degree, the UK as well.
And perhaps a little less emphasis on lobbying. Would that be a fair assessment? That at least the American system is far more influenced by lobbyings and political pressure than perhaps the EU?
I would agree to a certain extent, yes. And the conversations around ESG that tend to take a different tone in Europe. There is actually now a little bit of a backlash against climate rulemaking. So, you know, we've heard from French President Emmanuel Macron just a few months ago, you know, asking to pause all this rulemaking because it's cumbersome, and also to deal with all these rules coming out. And also recently, Ursula von der Leyen, the President of the European Commission, in her annual State of the Union address, she made a point of talking about competitiveness of the EU and companies and helping that competitiveness. And she mentions cutting red tape, cutting bureaucracy, which a few people interpreted as a watering down, potentially, of disclosure rules, sustainability disclosure rules. There are also there is also a push, particularly from Germany, to exclude from these rules the smaller companies part of the SME group. And so politics does play a role, particularly in a sort of an election years. The EU will vote on a new parliament next year, and of course the US is choosing a new president in less than 2 months. So so there are discussions around this. Politics does play a role, but it tends to take a different color in Europe. In the US, it tends to be more about do not talk about ESG, but we are the ones that are still committed about dealing with it, even simply from a physical risk, or just, you know, more broadly risk perspective, they will still do so. That's what they tell us.
Really? Yeah, love that view, because I think even if somebody's deeply involved in the conversation, it's hard sometimes to determine. Clearly, Australia would seem to be pro-mining, perhaps pro-LNG. Europe.
The different nuances around the energy sources and of course nuclear, right? I mean, we were chatting about recording now about nuclear, and of course even within Europe, I mean, it's split. So France is very much pro-nuclear, Germany is very much against it.
Right.
And so again, it's a political discussion.
Yeah, very much. Well, I'm glad you're in that conversation. I think we'll start winding up, but I love to ask this question. We love to give you a magic wand. And you use that magic wand one time for one thing in the next 1 year that you think would have the biggest impact regarding climate discussion, climate change. How would you use your wand?
I think I would use my wands in a really idealistic way.
As you should.
And and get policymakers to be honest and realistic in the way in which they communicate about their actions and what they can do.
I want to ask you a lot more questions about that, but I think I'll leave it at that. Because so that would imply that sometimes you think policymakers are not being honest about their actions.
Honest is a strong word, isn't it? But yeah. I think that they can't always say exactly.
Perhaps they have a hidden agenda or
perhaps
alternative
they feel,
agendas.
Or perhaps, and this maybe also should reflect on the media, perhaps they feel that what they say may be distorted or end up being exaggerated, perhaps in the way in which it is reported. But that tends to be historically and this is not just policymakers, so I should just say people rather than policymakers. So this should also refer to companies. There has been a tendency to maybe overestimate or overstate one's commitments around climate, which is now coming and biting everyone. because people are paying attention. And so we've had, you know, we're talking about litigation, and there are a number of cases around greenwashing. So people actually taking up whether a company against a company, so a competitor's kind of case, or individuals and complaining about the use in which certain companies are talking about their sustainability credentials or their green labels. And so again, perhaps I shouldn't just ask this of policymakers, but just of people in general, maybe including journalists.
We'll give you that amendment. Let me ask you, just as a person who really is deeply immersed in the financial world, what is the role of a corporation? Where are they most responsible to their shareholders, to their customers, or to their communities?
It's a fascinating question, and I would love to actually take some time off and study this question away from my day-to-day job, because yes, what is capitalism? What do we ask of companies? What should be their role? So there is the law. You know, when we talk about be respectful of what happens along your supply chains, to not break human rights. Yes, of course you shouldn't, because that's the law. In the same way, do not pollute in a way that is really incredibly detrimental to people's health. Again, there are laws for that. But here we are. So what are we asking of companies? Perhaps we need to have this conversation all together, thinking about companies, thinking about rulemaking, thinking about politicians, and also thinking about individuals. But it's a question that I haven't quite answered yet. I think that it will be hard to find, to change the expectations of a company that isn't just being profitable. So the main objective is being profitable with a number of caveats. Mm-hmm. But it depends on how strong these caveats are, whether it's the law or whether it's societal pressure or even employee pressure.
It's a thorny issue if the product is potato chips or wine or clothing. It's even materially more thorny when the products are heat and power and light and transportation fuel. We've loved having you. Look forward to following you more and more, and best of luck on Sustainable Views. Love that. But thank you for joining us today on Path to Zero.
My pleasure. It was fun to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to a special edition of Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins from Climate Week in New York City. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to path2zero@propane.com.